Right. Okay. So, and I don't even know the date now that I've done that.
So, I think it's the 7th of October.
So it's October 7th, and we are here from the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission to interview Secretary Snow. I'm Wendy Edelberg, and I'll just ask everyone then to go around and say their names.
Okay. This is Greg Feldberg with the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission.
Michael Gordon with the Treasury Department.
George Madison with Treasury.
John Snow, formerly with Treasury.
I'm Mitchell Berger with Patton Boggs here in Washington.
Super. And I guess, of course, first thing I want to say is thank you very much for agreeing to do this interview. We're really grateful, and particularly to do it now as we've learned a little bit more, gotten a bit more of a perspective.
Mm-hmm.
We're coming into the home stretch and actually writing our report, and these sorts of interviews with people like yourself who can, you know, give us the bigger picture are really valuable.
Yeah,
so thank you.
Delighted to do it.
And so I think, you know, just the first question is just the most obvious one. What do you think caused the financial crisis? Maybe we'll start there.
Yeah. That's a good opening question. Let me take you back to when I was in this building and what I saw. The financial crisis really grew out of a housing crisis.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a housing bubble, we now know it. And behind the housing bubble was finance. And the liquidity that was being made available to the housing markets. And that bubble was made possible, at least at the center of that bubble, was, I think, government policy encouraging housing ownership. But it wasn't just the policy encouraging housing ownership. It was the role of the GSEs in housing finance and driving the liquidity flowing into the housing markets. We saw that back when I was here, that the GSEs would presented a risk of an over-exuberant housing market, and I think it was 2003 that I first called on Congress to respond with setting up a strong regulator to oversee the GSEs with real capital standards for risk-based capital and ordinary capital, a regulator who could look at their leverage. And of course, in the end, they just took on way too much leverage and had very poor risk management. A regulator who could get at disclosures, who could oversee their balance sheet, because their balance sheet was ballooning out just hugely, and they were using this, I guess then was called implied guarantee. I think it became a guarantee, unfortunately, in the end, but to be able to borrow it at rates below any other players in the financial system except the U.S. Treasury. And that created, that was toxic, because they had a mandate to make the secondary market and promote housing. They also had a mandate to make money for their investors, because they were a public company listed on the exchanges.
Mm-hmm.
And the conflation of those objectives, shareholder value creation, housing with the implied guarantee, meant they could borrow money at lower rates than anybody, which meant they could then go out and invest in any kind of paper and make money on the spread. So they became, in effect, a huge hedge fund. In effect, a government-sponsored mm-hmm. hedge fund.
Mm-hmm.
And we could see this was dangerous, and I think it was repeatedly that I went up to the Hill and gave speeches and mm-hmm. tried to call attention to this danger, saying they're a danger to themselves, and of course, mm-hmm. in the end, when they blew up, I think they're the largest single liability to the U.S. taxpayers of any of the expenditures that the government has made as part of the crisis, larger than AIG, larger than GM, larger than mm-hmm. larger than any of them, mm-hmm. not by a little bit, but by a big, big factor. So, you ask me what caused it. I think we had a housing crisis. We had a housing bubble. Housing bubble was fuel on the housing bubble was the fuel for the housing bubble was the GSEs, and in the end, the housing market blew up. The GSEs blew up. A lot of counterparties blew up, mm-hmm. and the housing paper, the MBS. Because of securitization and then the slicing and dicing that went on, that paper ended up all over the financial system. And then, much later, we were proven correct that the paper was much riskier mm-hmm. than the market thought it was. And then that paper, that people who held that paper found they couldn't sell it for anything mm-hmm. like what they thought it was worth, what they had it on their books, mm-hmm. and then the panic spread to all paper because it began to affect all asset classes. Mm-hmm. But it started. I mean, I think my point is, we started with a housing mm-hmm. crisis. Housing crisis was certainly in large part the result of this funding mechanism that mm-hmm. poured funding into housing. Mm-hmm. The paper ended up being very risky paper, in part because of the roles of other entities like the rating agencies. But the paper got out there, and huge amount of funding for housing. And why did housing prices go up? Well, housing prices went up because there was easy financing for houses. People took advantage of easy. Financing for houses, and I guess I really come. I think some of your commissioners have made the same point, and things I've seen them say that mm-hmm. you won't understand this crisis that affected the whole financial system unless you put housing in its causative mm-hmm. role.
So I want to make sure that I understand something that you were just saying. You talked about the paper being worth less than people thought it was, that it turned out that the paper was risky. Are you saying GSE paper? Because it sounded like you were still talking about the GSEs when you were saying that the paper turned out to be risky.
It's the MBS paper, the mortgage-backed securities that right, they guaranteed.
Should I be thinking of agency MBS?
Yeah, I think you can think of all housing paper. I mean, housing paper is a class.
Right.
Found itself in a huge downdraft.
Well, so I guess.
And that was important, very important part of the capital structure of financial institutions.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I know that spreads moved remarkably on agency MBS, but looking at spreads and looking at trading, it looks like agency MBS and non-agency MBS are. GSE paper, non-GSE yeah. paper moved really differently. Is it in your minds? Are they the same, or
no.
should we actually be thinking of those as different?
I think you can think of them as different because the market right. treated them differently. But the larger point is that mortgage paper.
Right.
There was a flood of mortgage paper. There was a right. flood of borrowing, facilitated by Fannie and Freddie. That were backing that paper and buying that paper,
right? But when I guess at a certain point we'll get into the transmission mechanism between the housing crisis and the financial crisis as you see it, but touching on that point a little bit, how what's the transmission mechanism for the agency MBS and concern about those securities? What's the transmission mechanism between the MBS and the crisis? Because there's no losses on that, right?
Well, the transmission mechanism is excess financing for housing. Put it simple.
Right.
Let's keep
right.
it simple.
Right.
Let me make it real simple. We had a housing bubble.
Mm-hmm.
You wouldn't have had a housing bubble unless there'd been easy access to credit for houses.
Right.
Fannie and Freddie fueled that demand.
Right.
Because they made the credit mm-hmm. available. So, you know, then when people found that they couldn't pay their, when the housing prices started to stop rising and then mm-hmm. started to come down, mm-hmm. people found themselves in an uncomfortable position that the value they thought they had in that house, they didn't have.
Right.
And in fact, they found in many cases the value of the note was bigger than the value of the house, and they defaulted. Mm-hmm. So we started this cascade of defaults.
Right.
So we got overextended in housing.
So if we want to look for the primary source of this, to look at the primary source of the where we see the crash, the nexus of the housing crash, and the nexus of the households that have been affected by the housing crash, that first were affected by the easy credit and then affected by that housing crash. Should we be looking, is the nexus of that at those borrowers who had conforming loans that were GSE loans?
Well, I think it was Alt A, it was subprime, it was the
right.
whole range of loans. More loans got made. Let's make it simple. More loans got made than should have gotten made. I think that we can almost stipulate,
mm-hmm.
right? And because of Fannie and Freddie, more loans got made than otherwise would have been made. I think you can pretty much stipulate to that.
Mm-hmm.
Then Fannie and Freddie, we now know, engaged in fairly reckless behavior.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't transparent. They didn't conform to SEC rules on disclosure. They knew they were engaged in risky behavior, and they went out and bought an awful lot of derivatives to protect themselves against risks. Those derivatives ended up being concentrated in a small number of very large financial institutions, which made those financial institutions risky. Those are the transmission mechanisms.
Mm-hmm. Because it seems, you know, just staying a little bit for another minute on Fannie and Freddie, there are a couple of different ways where one can imagine they had a role in the crisis. First, as you say, they, you know, to the extent that they increased the availability of mortgage credit. And, you know, we didn't talk about which markets they were increasing mortgage credit in, but I would guess that you would want to look at the markets that they increased mortgage credit in to really see where they had an effect.
Yeah, but I would also say that, you know, markets are interrelated. So as you affect valuations, interest rates, in one market, you tend to affect, you know, that's why the Fed has such significance on the world, because they can affect interest rates in one market, and that plays off into other markets. I think financial markets are interconnected.
Mm-hmm. So should I interpret what you're saying that Fannie and Freddie, by increasing liquidity, by, you know, easing access to mortgage credit in conforming markets, would then have knock-on effects of easing access to credit in non-conforming markets?
Oh, yeah. I think the Fannie and Freddie were dangerous because they took their borrowing advantage
mm-hmm.
and systematically moved it through the housing markets, which meant the cost of capital to housing was lower than it otherwise would be, which meant the demand for housing was higher than it otherwise would be. That's what happens when you lower the cost. When you underprice risk, you get more risk-taking. All right?
Right.
And that's economics 101, as I remember my economics 101.
And then the other way of thinking about, I mean, tell me if you disagree, that the two ways that one can look at the role of Fannie and Freddie in the crisis is, one, their effect on mortgage credit. And so we talked a little bit about how that transmission mechanism might work. And then just almost as quite a separate way that they could affect the crisis is simply their systemic importance.
Right.
Is that second part
They're both.
Important?
Absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, back in 2003 when I first said, and others in Treasury were saying, that Fannie and Freddie presented systemic risks, hardly anybody had heard of a systemic risk. You know, and what of course we meant by systemic risk was you can bring the whole system down. It isn't just your activities, but it's the whole financial system, because they were, my gosh, I don't have the numbers at the top of my head anymore, but they'd gone from, I don't know, 150 billion or so in 1990 to a trillion and a half or something of exposure in 2000 and early 2000s, and there was no stopping it because they could take that borrowing advantage and arbitrage it and make money on any kind of paper. And so we were looking at this and saying, my God, there's no end to how big they're going to be.
Right.
They're already monstrous, and there's no end to how monstrously huge and dangerous they're going to become. And they had to hedge those risks. They knew they were taking a lot of risks. You know, they had repayment risks and interest risks and so on, and they were fixed interest instruments, long dated, short term financing. I mean, just the perfect sort of dynamite for a financial crisis. And they didn't have a regulator like the OCC or the Fed. They had a very small, fairly weak regulator. And what I was trying to do was put a brake on them, you know, put a brake on them and their financial arbitrage practices, which it seemed to me were, as I said, they're creating systemic risks. They need a strong regulator to limit and contain those risks. The leverage, forget the numbers, but their leverage was way beyond the leverage that the Fed would allow a bank, or the OCC would allow a bank, 30-to-1 or something. Their capital was very thin for the enterprises of the size they were. So if anything ever happened, they were going to blow up. And my concern wasn't so much they would blow up, is that they would bring so many others down with them. That was the major point. And that all the time, putting out, you know, driving down the availability of low-cost mortgage loans was driving the demand up for loans. So they were putting fuel on the fire. They were blowing air into the bubble, however you want it, whatever metaphor you want to use. You know.
Yes, they will all be in our book.
All those metaphors. There are a lot of metaphors, right. And you've probably heard them all, but pick the one you want. But that's the connection that I see.
And you talked about how this was one of the forces that you saw in the early 2000s.
Early days.
Yes.
Yeah.
Are there other changes in the environment or things that concerned you that you saw throughout the financial system?
Well, sure. There's everything gets interrelated and connected, and we saw the global imbalances as a fundamental backdrop. U.S. pretty clear. The U.S. needed to save more, and it'd be good if China had higher domestic consumption. Now, those were issues we talked about at the G20 and the G7 and the G8 and the bilateral meetings at IMF, World Bank meetings, and private meetings with the leaders of the IMF and the World Bank and China's finance ministers and so on and so forth. So there was...
And we'll take them one by one. And what concerns you about the global imbalances?
Well, global imbalances dangerous because they create potential huge disruptions in the system through currency adjustments. They have a mechanism for it's the excess pressure in the tank that's got to get let off somehow. You can let the pressure off if the U.S. Had a recession. Nobody wanted that to happen. That would let some pressure off, right? That would reduce our consumption. Mm-hmm. You can let some pressure off if people in other parts of the world that have a capital surplus engage in higher propensities to consume, mm-hmm. consume more. So they use their own the surplus they have in their own economies, and then they tend to push prices up in their own economies,
right?
And raise the standard of living of their people. And one way you do that is through currency adjustments. But if you don't let either, something's got to adjust when you got imbalances. It's either the currency or it's the economy, the macro economy. And we want to make sure that we got the best possible adjustment mechanism through this process. So we did the least disruption. And, probably seen, I talked a lot about the twin parts of the problem. We needed to save more. Our savings rates were negative for a number of years. And we consumed more than we produced for a number of years. We had persistent current account deficits. Other parts of the world, the Middle East, Germany, China, had persistent current account surpluses. That created, your Mr. Bernanke, Chairman Bernanke, used to talk about saving surpluses in the world and the dangers of the saving surplus and the glut of global savings and adverse potential consequences.
So certainly some of the potential consequences that people were worried about at the time is that, If you have huge net inflows, that can become huge net outflows, and that can be incredibly disruptive. I guess what I'm puzzled about is when you say rather than have these large net inflows, what we should have done is swapped the net inflows for increased savings in the U.S. That wouldn't have changed the savings glut. The sloshing of money would have still been
money. Well, no, but we wouldn't have created as much demand for the products from other parts of the world if we were saving more. Our consumption, savings is the other side of consumption, so if savings goes up, consumption has to come down in the the GDP equation. So it would have been a healthy adjustment if the U.S. had begun saving more. It would have been a healthy adjustment if China had begun consuming more.
Right.
Then we wouldn't have had these huge imbalances.
But we still would have had the same amount of money to invest in housing if that's how we chose to invest the amount of savings in the U.S. I guess I was presuming that you were thinking that the global imbalances were problematic in how they had something to do with asset prices.
Well, sure. I mean, when you get large, I think Chairman Bernanke talked about this at length back in 2002, trying to figure out why are interest rates so low. Remember that big, and the Fed Greenspan's conundrum.
Yes.
Remember the conundrum?
Yes, I do.
Okay. Well, it was the conundrum.
Right.
We're lower in short-term rates. Why aren't long-term rates coming down?
But if saving rates in the U.S. had gone up, that would have put even more pressure on long-term interest rates to fall.
Well, not if savings rates in other parts of the world went down. And saving rates in other parts of the world would presumably go down if we were consuming less from those parts of the world.
So, okay, so then the other counterfactual is that saving rates in the U.S. go up commensurate with saving rates in the other rest of the world going down, then we would have no effect on the long-term interest rate.
Well,
I mean, I appreciate that it is absurd that I am having this conversation with the former Treasury Secretary, but I'm just trying to understand.
Well, I think there are people who make a living on all sides of the debate about why interest rates go one way or another or why currencies go one way or another. But you asked me what other things were on my mind.
Absolutely, yes.
And one of the things that was on my mind was global imbalances.
Fair enough.
And I thought about risks to the financial system. Another thing on my mind was the terrorist threats through the financial system to break down the payment systems.
Right.
Disrupt the ability to conduct banking operations. Treasury has a big program to sort of harden the financial system with the Fed. But also, I recognized that our financial regulatory system really wasn't up to the task of the modern world. We had these pigeonholes. We had these bifurcations. We had lack of a 360 degree regulator. We compartmentalized oversight of the financial market. I think the bill has made a little progress there, not as much as I'd like to see, but at least there's an effort to get a systemic regulator, which was something that we were working on here at Treasury back in, I guess, 2005, 2004, 2005, through the Office of Finance, the Undersecretary for Financial Policy, because it was pretty clear that the architecture of our financial regulatory system wasn't up to the modern developments in financial markets, and we should be thinking about a new financial regulatory system, and commissioned the Undersecretary for Financial Policy, then Randy Quarles and his very able deputy Emil Henry, to put together a blueprint. What should the financial regulation look like? So we moved on that. We recognized that there wasn't a systemic regulator. We'd get together with the various regulators from time to time and talk about issues in the financial system, but there was nobody really overseeing systemic risks. And as I've said before, it's like the elephant and the blind people. They each felt a piece of it, but nobody saw the whole thing. So saw the need for modernization of financial regulation with a systemic risk regulator. Also, in probably 2005, we saw signs that there was troubling developments in debt markets, mortgage markets. The growth of subprime, growth of Alt-A, growth of expansion of what they then called exotic. I don't think we called them ninja loans or liar loans then, but there was a feeling, you could get a sense. I mean, that's the Treasury's not a regulator,
right?
But Treasury has a responsibility to provide some oversight of the financial system and to propose policies.
Do you recall when you
oh, I do
these
indeed.
Came on your radar?
Yeah, I think it was probably early 2005, maybe late 2004. I remember being concerned and inviting all the regulators, the Fed, the OCC, the FDIC, the credit union oversight body, OTS, the whole range, filled the room. We couldn't do it in this room. We had to do it in the much bigger room. And you'll recall, of course, that after the savings and loan bust up, that collapse, Congress wanted to make sure that Treasury didn't get involved in regulation of financial institutions, and in effect put out an edict that Treasury was to keep their hands off the regulatory agencies, even though some of them are housed in Treasury. Treasury is not to be directly involved in the decisions the regulators make. But we did have an oversight responsibility, so exercising the oversight responsibility, I probably came up as close to that line as you can go without going over it by calling in all the regulators and saying, let's have a discussion about what you're seeing in the debt markets. We're seeing some troubling things, some things that at least raise concerns. Try and put a spotlight on it and get your reaction. And there ensued a number of meetings between the Treasury Department and the regulators, and out of that came gradually some new guidance on subprime and the other things. But back then, the issue was simpler things like balloon payments and no interest loans, mm-hmm. and negative amortization, I think, was a sort of loans. And I remember talking to Alan Greenspan and other regulators about it, and there was a general sense that something we needed to be on top of was going on in the debt markets.
Mm-hmm. And do you feel like did they share your sense?
Well, I was struck by that meeting, again, confirmed my view. Nobody had a full 360-degree view. The basic reaction was, well, there may be a problem, but it's not in my field of view. Maybe a problem, but we don't really see it. Our default rates are very low. Our institutions are very well capitalized. Our institutions have very low delinquencies. So we don't see any real big problem. This was early 05. Well, they were all looking at different. Nobody saw the whole picture, and everybody tends to think the things they regulate are, you know, being regulated well and are healthy and strong and so on. I think it's just the way it goes. But it confirmed my view. We needed to redouble our efforts on a blueprint for the financial system and on a systemic regulator. But some good came from those discussions because, as I say, new guidance was issued.
That's right.
New guidance was issued. I think Governor Boies came from your agency. She was the
Boies.
Governor Boies, who was responsible for regulatory activities at the Fed.
So what were the signals? Was it the quality of the products, the type of products being offered, or was it the housing prices themselves?
Well, it was the combination. You can have low defaults and low delinquencies and well-capitalized institutions as long as prices are rising. But the issue is what happens when prices stop rising. And we now know that the models the banks were using were flawed in that they continued to build in rising demand for housing and rising housing prices. So, you know, it's not all that comforting to know the delinquencies are low and capital is high if the models think that they're always going to be, housing prices will always rise. So it was important to begin a discussion anyway with the regulators about their models and what are you looking at.
So did the regulators agree that house prices were already inflated at that
point? Well, we saw it. I mean, you could see that housing prices were rising. But they were not way out of norm.
Right.
They were not way out. When you talk to the housing economists, the view was, yes, they're rising. They're way out of norm. They're not way out of the norm. These tend to be local markets, not national markets, was the view. And in 04, 05, there was in retrospect, on the part of the regulators, too much complacency about the housing paper. But I come back to it. Mm-hmm. We wouldn't have been in the fix if there hadn't been so much housing paper financed. And the housing paper financing was really made possible in large part by Fannie and Freddie.
Mm-hmm. But so two questions. So late 04, early 05, sure. In terms of the kinds of loans that you were seeing that troubled you. So one question is, I just want to ask more a little bit more directly a question that's already asked, which is, were you already at that point worried there was a housing bubble?
I wouldn't say I was worried that there was a housing bubble at that time, but I wanted to put a spotlight on the concern.
Right.
That's what I tried to do. Put a spotlight on a concern. And I was trying to deal with the thing that I thought would make the biggest change in the housing markets and the prospects of a calamity, and that was the GSEs. Mm-hmm. That's why I kept returning. Right. I got like to be a broken record, I think, up in the Congress, coming up there and saying, if you don't rein this in, it's going to end in calamity.
Right.
And you know, Chicken Little, the sky hasn't fallen yet. The sky's not going to fall. Well, I think history would have been different if Congress had acted back then. Because the regulator could have stopped this explosion, man, literally explosion, in their held portfolios. You know.
So did you speak to that? I mean, you mentioned the bank regulators. Did you speak to the GSE's regulator at the time?
Well, I was, yes. And the GSE regulator, Mr. Falcone, was in agreement that he needed more tools. Mm-hmm. He had these massive entities who were really engaging in reckless behavior and didn't have the tools to stop it. Mm-hmm. Now that's dynamite in the financial system.
So, but you know, just one. I think one last question on this: in the late 04, early 05, when you were having those meetings with regulators. And you were concerned about, I guess, what I'll say is non-traditional mortgages.
Yeah.
Were you at that point concerned about loans that the GSEs were making? Did you see was that part of the same conversation? Well, and let me put that in a little bit of a context in that some have argued that now we have a much better window into some of the ways that the GSEs pushed out the risk curve. And I guess I want to know if, when you were saying that this was all, you know, you, for whatever you were seeing in late 04, early 05, this was really a GSE-led problem, is it because did you see that were the non-traditional mortgages you were worried about GSE loans?
I was worried that the GSEs were a systemic threat because they were becoming so huge.
Right.
I mean, a trillion and a half.
Right.
From $150 billion over a 15-year period, what's the end of this?
Right.
And the business is inherently risky. I mean, let's remember what they were doing.
But
their asset was a fixed income instrument with a long duration.
Right.
Their financing was short term.
But the non-traditional mortgages you were worried about in late 04, early 05, it sounds like then those were maybe exclusively non-GSE mortgages.
We were worried about the general condition of lending. Were the lenders, were the lending institutions managing risk effectively? Or was there a growing laxity in lending standards? That was the direct conversation with the regulators, and I asked them to look at that and give me their views on it and con- consider what should be done about it. Now, the GSEs were a regular subject with Mr. Greenspan and with the President's Working Group. There was a general agreement that the GSEs had to be fixed because they were inherently risky, and they had such a the rest of the financial system had such exposure to them.
I think the question Wendy's trying to get at is, what had emerged in 2004 and 2005 was non-traditional loans, subprime loans that weren't the GSEs, and you had a bunch of regulators, and they said it's not our banks either. So, you know, what was driving the non-traditional mortgage and the subprime markets at that time?
Well, what was driving it, I suppose, was the search for yield, mm-hmm. right? Yields, you remember, had come down, mm-hmm. and the market welcomed these these mortgage products that got sliced and diced and then securitized mm-hmm. and sent out. Mm-hmm. But it started with mortgages. Mm-hmm. And they got sliced and diced and put in, and then they got rated, and the ratings were wrong, and mm-hmm. and so on. But it had to get funded. I mean, this wouldn't have happened unless mm-hmm. there was somebody standing there ready to buy these mortgages mm-hmm. and guarantee them.
So, backing up a little bit, you talked about how you could, how it was clear to you in the early part of the decade that the regulatory system needed to be modernized, that it was insufficient. Mm-hmm. Are there specifics you can point to? Where should we be looking if we are looking at the regulatory system for things that were
missing? The gaps?
Yes, please.
We didn't have a strong regulator for the GSEs. I'd start with that. I think that was the biggest single problem. And of course, they did blow up and brought a lot of havoc with the biggest single exposure of the taxpayers by a huge factor is the GSEs. We didn't have a systemic risk regulator. Nobody really had responsibility for oversight of systemic risks. Mm-hmm. That was a big gap.
Well, I guess when you say systemic risk at the time, you define systemic risk mostly as the GSEs. I mean, were there other...
Systemic risks, I mean things that can cause the financial system mm-hmm. To blow up.
Mm-hmm. Right. So when you look back at that time, I mean, was there concern about the growth of the repo market, the growth of the commercial paper market, mm-hmm. the fact that commercial paper was, you know, that more and more of the repo market was actually backed by risky mortgage assets? Did any of that make it onto your radar screen?
Well, the overdoing of housing paper is certainly a matter of concern. Mm-hmm. Sure.
Right. But what are there regulations that, I guess, let me just ask the question the other way. I'll put up a straw man and you'll tell me why it's wrong. So aside from, if there had been, let's say, if OFAO had been very strong, and there had been, and the president's working group, let's say, had been given the authority it needed to actually, you know, deal with systemic risks as they saw them, perhaps you even want resolution authority, something like that. If you had had those two things, would then you have said that the regulatory system is modernized and we're done?
No. What you need in a well-functioning financial system is discipline, market discipline. Mm-hmm. And you don't get market discipline if you underprice risk. And I just went through why I think risk got underpriced. Because of the guarantee. And you don't get financial discipline. You can't get financial discipline if investors think an institution is too big to fail. And if an institution is too big to fail, and Fannie and Freddie Review is too big to fail, they get money on preferential terms to other players in the market. So you're feeding this underpricing of risk.
Right.
So you need market discipline. People have to be able to fail. And I mean, from my point of view, the failure of Dodd-Frank is the failure to deal with too big to fail. Mm-hmm. It didn't deal with it effectively. In fact, it may have institutionalized too big to fail. It may have put the Fed in the position of being a custodian of all systemically risky institutions. Now, if you're the custodian of financial, of systemically risky institutions, you probably want to encourage them to behave in ways that they won't blow up.
Right.
But that means you're taking out of the financial system the sort of real discipline which competition, market competition, brings. So, I mean, I wish your commission, wish Congress could have waited for your commission to complete its work, because I think it would have benefited from, I mean, they were under pressure to deal with some, the thing, but I think they would have benefited, and maybe still can benefit from the work you do. But, I mean, I don't know how we get our financial system working right as long as we underprice risk and as long, which comes from implied guarantees and too big to fail. Right. And as long as we have too big to fail institutions, seems to me we're just asking for trouble.
And are there other institutions beside the GSEs, or are Fannie and Freddie the only institutions you worry about?
Oh. Now or previously? I have to worry about the time frame of that question.
True enough. I'm happy to say at the time.
Well, yeah, at the time,
my
focus was Fannie and Freddie. They were right before us. We saw that. We saw those risks. They
so
were
in fact,
clear.
So then when you actually say what we needed was a systemic risk regulator, was that really? I mean, is that basically the same comment as we needed a stronger OFAO?
No,
or was there something
separate,
else?
They're separate.
So then what other systemic risks did you see then besides Fannie and Freddie?
Well, what I wanted was a regulator who could see them.
Right.
I wanted somebody to be in a position with responsibility to come to the president's working group and say, here's where the risks are. They're they're in X, Y, or Z. No, I'm not saying that I had prescience to see all the systemic risks. Nobody can. But you'd like to have somebody as a watchdog with authority.
Right.
Now, apparently the Fed is being given that authority under Dodd-Frank to come in and have conversations with people who are systemically risky. To mitigate those risks.
So have we learned from this crisis that there are actually other institutions that
sure.
are too big to fail?
Well, I think we've learned from this crisis that there are institutions that are too big to fail. Let's go through the history of what's happened here. Right?
So I want to ask a similar question, but back up a little bit, which is, so at the time, when you were thinking we needed a systemic risk regulator and we didn't have one, we're advocating for it, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but are you saying that the only systemic risk that you saw was Fannie and Freddie, or at the time, did you see other potential systemic risks?
Well, Fannie and Freddie were a clear systemic risk. They were the one that we identified and we focused on.
I guess the question is, are there others?
Are there others today?
Were there others at the time that you worried about as potential systemic risks?
Sure, there are always out there things that you hope somebody is watching for. I mean, things can blow up.
Worry about?
Things can go wrong. Well, I'm worried about anything that could blow up. Right? But the thing that was clearest on our radar screen was Fannie and Freddie and housing. That was what was right before us.
I guess what I'm trying to put meat on is when we talk about your efforts to Treasury's efforts of calling for we need a systemic risk regulator. This is one of the fundamental problems with the regulatory system. I guess I want to know, aside from Fannie and Freddie, were there any other things in your mind of why you were calling for that?
Well, you call for it because you want safeguards.
Right.
You need safeguards in a
right. So there were no specifics.
Fannie and Freddie were specific.
Aside from Fannie and Freddie, those were the only specific risks you saw.
But you worry about things you don't see, right? You got to worry about things you don't see, but that somebody who has Treasury was not the systemic risk regulator, right? Treasury's role was a policy role. We didn't have any regulatory authority. We had no authority over the financial institution's direct authority, except under the Patriot Act or something. You know, but none on safety, but none on safety and soundness. So Treasury is not a safety and soundness regulator, but it's part of Treasury's role to be involved in the policy process. And as we thought about the policy, we said the system would, the financial system would needs somebody who is thinking about systemic risks with authority to act on it, even though you don't know at this point what the systemic risks are. Although Fannie and Freddie clearly are a systemic risk, we identified it. We called on Congress to ask. We called on Congress to put in place a much stronger regulator.
Looking back, are we allowed to ask this? What would you have liked to have had on your radar, looking back and realizing how the crisis played itself out?
I'd like to have had a strong regulator at Fannie and Freddie.
Other things?
There's other too big to fail institutions. Are there?
There are other markets that were disrupted.
Yeah, I mean, clearly we had a big meltdown of the financial system as a whole, and what we've discovered in retrospect is that the financial system wasn't resilient enough to deal with the circumstances that it found itself in with with the global imbalances.
So now, of course, I'm going to ask, why do you think it wasn't resilient?
Well, it wasn't resilient enough because we didn't have a modern financial regulatory architecture. It wasn't resilient enough because we had instrumentalities like Fannie and Freddie that were feeding huge amounts of risk into the system that shouldn't have been happening. Historians will be studying this, economic historians, for years. Why did this really happen? When you're in office, you focus on the things that are right before you. You know, when you're in the arena, you don't have the time to be highly speculative. You got to deal with the risks you see, the things you see. And the risks we saw were the housing market risks and the financial system risks posed by Fannie and Freddie. So that's why I focused on that.
It was interesting when we asked about why the system wasn't resilient enough, you mentioned the financial regulatory architecture, but what would the regulators have to see in the system?
Didn't have the transparency. Mm-hmm. See, the big problem was transparency. Mm-hmm. They didn't see it. Fed didn't see it.
Right.
Mm-hmm. OCC didn't see it. OTS didn't see it. Mm-hmm. Nobody was in a position to see it. I think some of the reforms that have been made, putting derivatives, standardized derivatives, through exchanges with capital requirements makes sense. We now realize we need to focus much more on liquidity, not just the capital structure of financial institutions, but their liquidity. You learn. I mean, every crisis teaches us lessons. This one, I think clearly the market itself will demand more capital. Basel III will demand more capital. Regulators in the United States will demand more capital. There's my hope that living wills will be put in place, and the market will look at the living wills and say these entities are riskier than we thought they were. So when we put funds into these entities, we're going to do it at higher risk premiums, higher interest rates. So the institutions will be getting funds on at a higher cost of capital to them, which will be good. Be good to get risk priced right. So I think the things that are beginning to be done will help to price risk right. That's and liquidity plans. I mean, financial institutions need to think, what's my contingency when things go wrong?
Right.
How do I fund myself? I think coming out of this crisis, greater attention to how do we fund ourselves? This is one of Mervyn King's great contributions to this episode of well, we've got to find a way to fund ourselves. So I think regulators will learn some lessons here, and they're going to be given some new tools mm-hmm. that will help them play their role better. But you're never probably going to change human nature, which is the animal spirits that Keynes wrote about.
Mm-hmm.
When times are good, our human psychology is to think they'll always be good. When they're bad, it's to think we'll never get out of this mess. So in good times, lending standards get eroded. In difficult times, they get raised, so only people who don't need borrowing can get borrowing. I mean, I don't think we change that.
Mm-hmm.
I hope that maybe some of these actions that have been taken by the Congress will make the next almost inevitable crisis less severe and less damaging.
So you mentioned derivatives. In what way do you see derivatives having played a role in the crisis or
I don't think derivatives were you know proximate cause in any way.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
But you mentioned transparency.
I think transparency. Sure, transparency is important.
Mm-hmm.
Regulators didn't see the growth of CDS,
mm-hmm.
but you'd be much more current on this than I am, but mm-hmm. I don't think we ended up having big problems in FX derivatives.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think we had big problems in interest rate derivatives.
Mm-hmm.
CDS was really not heavily on the screen when I was there because it developed really heavily later, but...
Mm-hmm.
The Dodd-Frank will hopefully put more transparency on CDS and more capital next to it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so you mentioned capital. In retrospect, would the crisis have been, I'll just posit this because it's kind of obvious. I assume you would say that the crisis would have been less severe mm-hmm. had institutions held more capital.
Yeah, I think if they had held more capital, they would have had lower risk profiles and may have taken less risk. It would have had a higher cost of capital.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And they could have covered their bad bets more effectively. Sure, I think capital. But on the other hand, I don't want to mislead you. I don't think any amount of capital that's reasonable will forestall the next crisis. We got a fractional banking system, and if we're going to get the benefits of a fractional banking system, you're going to have some capital at risk, and there's no amount of capital that's sufficient to deal with a bank that's taken on excessive risks. This won't be enough.
Right, but so somehow we have to square that with the comment where you said that it'll be a good thing that banks will hold more capital.
Well, I think it's a positive thing, but it's not a panacea.
Right.
That's all I'm saying.
Okay, fine. And so in 2003, 2005, around that time period, was there concern about capital being too slim?
Well, I don't know where you were then, but that was the days when Basel II was being debated.
Right.
And... the ironies here are plentiful mm-hmm. because the greatest experts in the world, the people who sat around the table at Basel II, were saying we need to relax these capital standards for the biggest banks. And that, of course, caused a lot of concern among community banks and smaller banks. And community banks and the smaller banks ended up having a lot of influence, and those Basel II rules got slowed down a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And in effect, Basel II rules were taking us the wrong way,
mm-hmm.
right? They were putting more risk into the financial system, not less. We talked a lot about capital rules back then. That was a regular subject of the working group.
Mm-hmm. And investment banks? Did the leverage ratios at the investment banks make it onto your radar screen?
You mean Goldman and
Bear and Lehman Bear, and Merrill Lynch.
And the four or five of them, yeah. Yep. Well, I can't recall specifically discussions on leverage ratios or capital ratios for bank holding companies or investment banks and so
right.
on. That really isn't Treasury's right. direct responsibility.
But I guess I'm given how influential those five institutions were in the financial system.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I'm assuming that part of Treasury's purview is to make sure that those five institutions are doing responsible things and not putting the system in danger. Were you either worried about those institutions? You also talked about liquidity plans.
Right.
Were you worried about those institutions' dependence on, and then we can move over to the traditional banking
right.
sector, those institutions' dependence on short-term money or those institutions' level of leverage? And then if you could also say anything about your
yeah.
what you thought about the CSC program.
Well, as I say, the SEC and others had responsibility for the bank holding companies and for the investment banks and the voluntary program that Chairman Donaldson put in place. So we deferred to other agencies who had direct responsibility on those matters. So no, I mean I looked to others to be the primary oversight on those institutions.
So I guess just to put a fine point on it then. So the risk taken by the investment banks or the effectiveness of the oversight of the CSC program didn't worry you?
Well, it wasn't a direct responsibility.
Right, but nonetheless, did it worry you?
As I say, I deferred to the people who were directly responsible and knowledgeable about bank holding companies and about investment
right.
banks and so on. And the Fed has a lot of good people. The
right.
SEC had a lot of good people. The mm-hmm. SEC increased its staff during that period significantly.
Right.
And Chairman Donaldson was a very forward leaning.
Mm-hmm.
Leader of that institution, had a good radar for the risks in those capital markets that he was responsible for. The Fed had strong leadership for the things they were responsible for. I mean, that's
right.
that's the direct responsibility of other
right.
agencies.
So, from your vantage point, the Fed was doing I don't mean adequate in a negative way. They were doing a perfectly adequate job in their supervisory
role. Well,
I didn't. And the SEC was doing a perfectly adequate job.
I looked to them to do a good job. I didn't do an internal audit on the job they were doing.
Okay.
I just looked to them. I knew the people who were running those agencies. I knew a lot of people in the agencies. I had great respect for the regulators. And for the staff they had,
right.
and the resources they had to look into those issues. So, in government you get compartmentalized. You know,
right.
you're not you defer to people who have direct responsibility.
I guess I'm trying to understand your. I'm trying to put side by side your. The great deal of knowledge you had about OFAO as a regulatory
right.
agency against the other regulatory agencies
yeah.
that you basically were more hands-on.
Well, because it was the gap.
Right.
I was focusing on the
okay.
gap.
Yeah. And so CSC was not a gap. That
no,
program
I think
did not expect
I didn't
gaps.
See. I didn't see the Fed as a gap.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I didn't see the OCC as a gap. I saw OFAO as a gap.
Right.
It just didn't have the tools that these other agencies had
okay.
to rein in excessive risk-taking. That's why we focused on it.
Yep.
And because they were so gigantic and growing and becoming more and more of a threat to the system, if they weren't reined in, you know, as I said, they're a risk to the whole system and they're going to blow up. And, you know, rarely in life You're young, but it'll come to you too. Rarely in life do you get a chance to say, you know, I told you so. Huh? And I do it reluctantly because I wish it had been different. But it's a shame Congress didn't act on that back then.
So what's your explanation? Why was it so difficult to get that passed through Congress?
Fannie and Freddie were the most powerful single lobbying force in town. I mean, they had a fantastically valuable asset. The sense in the marketplace that they were backed by the federal government, which allowed them to sell their paper at a price closer to U.S. Treasuries than any other institution, which was a statement by the marketplace that you are either the government or right next to the government. You are the closest thing to the government going, which means you're not going to fail. And that was a huge asset, and it allowed Fannie and Freddie to make extraordinary amounts of money for a long period of time and pay their executives very handsomely for a long period of time. And they knew that if they were going to continue this government-sponsored hedge fund taking advantage of this, in effect, government subsidy, government-backed subsidy, they needed the support of Congress. And so they became a government-sponsored hedge fund with a powerful lobbying wing to sustain their market advantage. No, go back and look at the records, how much they spent on lobbying every year. You'll be astonished.
Should we also be looking then at lobbying expenditures by financial firms?
Well, the Fannie and Freddie were lobbying to sustain an unfair advantage, you know, the advantage of being a government-backed institution, which they didn't like my saying it, but was their comparative advantage, and they were running with this. And they're running with this advantage was the source of the risk. This ability to borrow at lower costs and then go buy other paper and arbitrage the differences, and just grow and grow and grow and make huge profits and pay yourself well, and grow your stock option values and grow your equity values, all dependent on sustaining this asset, their greatest asset. Was the perception in the marketplace that they were a government-backed entity. And a strong regulator who would have come in and put in resolution authority and living wills and limited their ability to purchase paper not related, mortgage paper not related to their purpose to make the secondary market, would have shrunk their market value enormously. Would have shrunk the option values enormously. So they were motivated by marketplace sort of incentives to sustain that advantage. But if you're going to sustain that advantage, you got to lobby. You got to be good with Congress.
So other firms were. Should I be thinking of other financial firms lobbying as just a different animal? They're not lobbying for their own advantage.
They're all lobbying for their own advantage. They're all lobbying for their own advantage. But I can't think of any other ones that has whose comparative advantage in the marketplace lies in being able to borrow at rates that are just a little over Treasury.
Right.
That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
I wouldn't confuse that.
Right.
That's what this is about. Sure. Railroads will lobby and department stores will lobby, and gas stations will lobby, and everybody will lobby. That's fine. That's the American way. What troubled me about Fannie and Freddie was they were sustaining something that was dangerous. They were sustaining a borrowing advantage that they used to build up huge portfolios that were inherently risky and that predictably would blow up one day. And with consequences across the financial system. That's why I never objected to the Gasoline Retailers Association lobbying for whatever they lobbied for. But I saw the lobbying of Fannie and Freddie is dangerous.
Because of what they were lobbying for, not
exactly.
Because of the act of lobbying.
No. It was because of what they were trying to accomplish. They were trying to sustain an advantage that, as they used it, created risks to them, to the housing market, and to the whole financial system, and as we now know, to the taxpayers. I mean, taxpayers are holding a huge bill from Fannie and Freddie. The biggest single bill by far, any bill, way bigger than Citi, way bigger than GM, way bigger than anything that you all are administering. That's the biggest.
Mm-hmm. So, can you tell us a little bit about the President's Working Group? I mean, I guess that had been created a long time before you became the Secretary. When you started, was that meeting frequently? How often did you
meet? Yeah, we met on a regular basis. It was an important part of what happened over here. Mm-hmm. It met, must be a record of all the meetings we had, but we met once a quarter or once every other month or something with an agenda. Mm-hmm. And the Undersecretary for Financial Policy prepared the agenda, called around to the other members to see what issues they wanted to put on it. Mm-hmm. There were, discussions on, it was the time to say what's on your mind, what are you thinking about, what are you worried about, what should we be thinking about, so on. It was a good give and take. Mm-hmm. But they met regularly, they were, and of course you talk to those people off, outside of the President's Working Group often too, on the pertinent issues.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, when you started, what were the main issues that were on the agenda that regulators were most concerned about?
You've got to search my memory here. I'd have to go back but issues, we'd get reports. It wasn't so much issues alone, it was reports. What are you working on at the SEC? What are you working on at the Commodities Future Trading Commission? There were differences of opinion on who had jurisdiction over certain kinds of instruments, financial instruments, the SEC or the Commodities Future Trading.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any recollection of specifics? Or?
Well, there was, I think, not. We ended up sort of being the broker to try and find a way to resolve the issues. I think it had to do with energy derivatives.
Mm-hmm. And do you remember when the SEC created its voluntary program? Do you remember any of the conversations?
Well, they advised us about it. It was part of the I would tell the group what I was working on and what issues we were dealing with. Mm-hmm. Currency issues, global imbalances, the G7 meetings coming up, the Basel II discussions, the others, participants, would talk about the things that they thought were relevant to the rest of the group that were coming from their bailiwick. So it was a way to keep posted, keep informed on things that most of the things they talked about was informational for the rest of us. We didn't have jurisdiction over what the SEC did with respect to registration of hedge funds or whatnot.
I mean, you had said that Congress had said after the savings and loan crisis that Treasury shouldn't have a role in regulation. Do you think that's a weakness? I mean, do you think it would have been better to have a stronger role?
Well, I certainly would have liked it.
Like
I certainly would have liked it. I can say that. I think we could have used it effectively. Congress had spoken. That was the law of the land. We had to respect the law of the land.
Mm-hmm.
Were there times I would like to have been able to been more forceful and direct? Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. And when it came to the when it came to the mortgage guidance you talked about, do you remember any discussions about that at the time?
Well, there was, I think, general agreement, certainly many discussions with Chairman Greenspan, and we were in full agreement that, that Fannie and Freddie were right at the center of the risks in the financial system, the biggest single risks we could identify. And he gave speeches on that, too. Testified. He and I testified together on it. So did Chairman Bernanke and I testify on that. I mean, that was the clear, visible risk.
Right.
And it became even more so as housing prices continued to rise and the fuel kept being put on the fire. So, and would I like to have been able to go over and direct the head of OFAO to stop Fannie and Freddie's continued building out of their portfolio of mortgage-backed securities? Absolutely.
But you also talked about the mortgage guidance that was put out,
which was a banking. Well, it was a banking thing.
But I mean, was that what you were asking about, though?
But that's different, though. OFAO was different.
I think you would have the meeting in early 05, which eventually led to the non-traditional mortgage guidance, which really was about the banks and the thrifts. I mean, do you remember some of the discussions? I mean, we've heard in many places that some regulators supported that more than others.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think that's true. We, and people, like I said, you're touching different parts of the elephant, and it feels different on one side than the other and so on. And there's a natural tendency for regulators, I'm sure the Fed's not immune from it, to think the people we regulate are really pretty good, because we regulate them. Well, you're not alone. Other regulators tend to think the people they regulate, they do a good job of regulating. They're pretty good people. They observe our rules. We hold them to high standards. But what did come out of the meeting was, as I say, probably more slowly than I would have liked, but over some period of time, new guidance as what we were. It was sort of a spur to things I think the regulators were already had on their mind, and this spurred them on, maybe.
So why did it take so long? It took almost 2 years, I think, from then.
To get
the guidance out?
Not for lack of Treasury interest, let me say. We were, as I say, walled off. We're walled off. We can't tell a regulator what to do.
I mean, a couple of the regulators have said, both the officials from the Federal Reserve, and I believe FCIC, even the FDIC, in testimony, said that one of the biggest failings was not regulating the mortgage market more aggressively. So I think, you know, do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I agree. I agree with them. We, at the highest level, we were saying, put a strong regulator in the biggest force in these markets, Fannie and Freddie. And I was saying to the regulators, you know, I hope you're being watchful of the quality of the loans that are coming out of these institutions, because we're getting gleamings that standards are being adulterated. That's as far as I could go.
Do you remember the reaction to Enron and this and SOX and how it was implemented? Was that ever on your radar?
Sure. I mean, that was happening in the early period of my time here at Treasury, and that was much in the air, there were a lot of voices on Wall Street saying this is going to be the end of us, and obviously Wall Street people would come in here and then go over the Fed and see us and raise their concerns about excessive burdens of of the SOX regulatory regime. Sure, that was much in the air. End of 02, that came into effect, and you know, it was getting implemented in 03 and 04. So sure, absolutely. That was one of the issues before the President's Working Group regularly. We'd get reports on how it was going.
So on the other hand, we hear from some people that this was a deregulatory environment through most of this period, And, you know, so SOX was going on, there were other things going on. But in general, it was a deregulatory trend, which a lot of people trace back to Gramsci-Bliley and even before.
Yeah.
I mean, to what extent did you feel that that was the atmosphere? And do you think that played a role?
No, I don't think.
I guess first two parts. Do you think that was the atmosphere?
Right.
I guess
no.
First part.
No, that's what I'm saying. What was I doing? I was going up the hill week after week saying we need a strong regulator. We need more regulation.
Right, right.
We need a regulator with more authority.
Well, I guess then just maybe the question is the flip side. Do you think one of the reasons that you weren't successful in your cries for that is because there was a deregulatory, sort of anti-regulatory atmosphere?
No, I don't think that had much to do with it. I think what had to do with it was the powerful lobbying force represented by Fannie and Freddie.
Right. So when
they were good at that. You got to take your hat off to them. They knew how to lobby.
Right.
Powerful.
Well, I guess, so more specifically, to Gramsci-Bliley, which a lot of people put right at the front of the list.
Right.
So it's one of the things we've talked about with a lot of folks. To what extent do you think that breaking down the Glass-Steagall separation between banks and investment banks was relevant?
I don't think it was directly relevant, directly causative at all, no.
And then maybe stepping back one layer, just more broadly, what some have looked at is the interconnections over time between the traditional banking sector and the parallel banking sector, if you will. And so I'll just spin the tail for a minute or two, something that's probably been said in these halls, I think, which is that, you know, for a time, we had something like a spare tire. These various financial sectors were able to help each other out, and maybe that was partly because they were different enough so that the same shock wouldn't hit both. I guess first thing is, do you think that that's true, that there was a spare tire, if you will? And second, did you see that changing over time as these two sectors change?
So-called, and it's really nebulous, you know. Always reluctant to use terms like that because I'm not sure what you have in mind. I'm not sure what I have in mind. But there was a lot of disintermediation going on outside of traditional banks. Mm-hmm. That we can agree on. And it appears that a lot of banks were engaged in non-traditional things as well, off-balance sheet sieves and things, non-balance sheet things, in order to be competitive with the non-bank disintermediation activities that were going on. Mm-hmm. But when you think about it, hedge funds, which are a big part of that non-bank world, didn't have much to do with the meltdown. Private equity didn't have much to do with the meltdown.
Not in systemic importance, but of course the hedge funds, what they were doing with their money certainly had a lot to do with the meltdown.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I didn't see hedge funds collapsing here, you know.
It doesn't make the headlines as much.
I think you'd have be hard put to say that hedge funds were the cause of the crisis. I mean, you got the cause of the crisis. Overpriced houses, overinvestment in houses, were at the heart of this thing. We wouldn't have had the financial meltdown without the housing crisis.
Well, maybe that sort of brings us full circle to where we began, of why did the collapse of the housing bubble have the effect that it did. So, and the example that I always think of when I ask that question is, you know, the tech bubble burst.
Right.
And in terms of the trillions of dollars, it's about the same order of magnitude as the loss of housing wealth.
Yeah.
Why did they have such very different effects on the financial system?
I think it touched the financial system in a more direct way because the capital of financial institutions was heavily tied to mortgages and MBS, and mm-hmm. and when the market came to the conclusion, which they did at some point, that this paper wasn't worth what the banks had it on the books at, mm-hmm. that it was much riskier than what the banks had it on, the paper got written down. I mean, and bank capital got written down. And banks knew, we're holding a lot of this paper that we know is pretty bad, so when Bank A calls Bank B and says, we need to do a swap with you, we need a loan arrangement with you, you say, what's your collateral? And you say, well, this MBS, you say, not on your tintype. We're not going to do that. Mm-hmm. So what happened was the whole banking system collapsed inward on itself because they didn't have good collateral. They didn't trust each other. It's and then the, you know, there was no market for this paper. When there's no market for an asset, it just collapses. And then it spread. You'll have to delineate how this all happened in your studies, but it spread to other asset classes. Mm-hmm. It spread to all asset classes. The panic, and that's the nature of a panic. People freeze up. So the panic spread. I don't think anybody really knows the full dynamics, the DNA of how that happens, but we know it does happen, and it spreads. And so we as a society, the global financial world, as a society, became horribly risk-averse, wouldn't trade with each other.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so all paper, all financial assets just collapsed in value, and you couldn't, commercial paper market collapsed, secondary markets collapsed in virtually everything. Mm-hmm. Corporates collapsed. Virtually every class of financial assets collapsed. Mm-hmm. It was fear. It was just plain fear. Mm-hmm. But the spark for the fear, which started it all, that's why I keep coming back to this, is housing. And housing was a big part of the balance sheet of financial institutions around the world.
Right. So I guess we've kind of got this in two stories. We've got the housing story and then the financial crisis and
right.
how that happened because of the housing crisis. And it does raise the question to what extent regulation could have prevented the second part from happening. I mean, what could have been done to make the financial sector more resilient?
The financial system would have been much more resilient there wasn't a systematic underpricing of risk mm-hmm. in these markets I've talked about, right? You underprice risk, you get more risk-taking. Mm-hmm. It would have been more resilient mm-hmm. if the market had known that big financial institutions could fail.
Mm-hmm.
That there was a process for winding them down in an orderly way. Because mm-hmm. then the investor would have been more careful, would have done more, what's the economist's word for this? There would have been less moral hazard in the system, right?
Mm-hmm.
A lot of moral hazard in a system where you can't fail. So, we'll put our money with you because we know we're going to get it back. But since we know we're going to get it back, we're going to put it to you at lower cost because it's safer. Then liquidity.
Mm-hmm.
There was underappreciation of liquidity, of the role of liquidity at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And we now know there was, because of the lack of transparency in the whole system, the regulators didn't see the extraordinary leverage.
Mm-hmm.
So visibility on leverage, I think, is the other big thing that comes out of this, which is where the registration or the going on the exchange for the CDS with capital is going to be helpful. So I think we've made some strides here.
Mm-hmm. I could ask questions for the next 3 hours, but I think we've covered a lot of ground.
Yeah. Good.
I think one, just thinking in my head about some of the cats and dogs, one thing that we haven't talked to, well, there are two things that we haven't talked about that I can think of. Mm-hmm. So you see I'm going into wind down mode.
Yeah.
You let me, okay, fine. There are two things that I can think of that we haven't talked about. One is, again, it's nebulous, but I'd like to get your reaction to it. Whether or not the financial system, sort of generally speaking, has changed over time. And by that I mean that the financial system has grown a lot. You know, it's a much larger percentage of GDP than it used to be 15,
right,
20 years ago, right?
Right, right.
And if I'm trying to find a way into this question. Maybe what I really mean is what in your mind, just very generally speaking, is the proper role of a financial system? What is it actually supposed to do? What is its role in society? And did its role in society change over time? It's a 10,000 foot question, but
yeah, no, it's a good question.
It's a good question. It's an excellent question. Yeah, I think we overdid finance versus the real economy, and got it a little lopsided as a result. Finance has a critically important role to play, of course, in moving capital from savers to investors, from originators of savings to people who can put it to better, higher use in terms of productivity for the economy. And I mean, that's absolutely essential for any well-functioning economy. Has to have a good finance system that takes capital from savers and puts it into people's hands who can use it well, and then it has to price it well.
Mm-hmm.
Always come back to that. It's got to price it right, so it the capital gets allocated to the right people based on the marginal productivity of capital in A's hands versus Industry B's hands versus Industry C's hands, and that's the role of financial markets, allocating capital to the best uses. Now, over the last 20 years, 30 years or so, the financial sector has grown relative to the real economy quite markedly. And I guess that reflects an awful lot of things, but one it reflects is that banks make so many loans to each other, mm-hmm. and financing each other's trades. And whatever verdict you come down on it, it's observable that financial sector is much bigger. And it's the growth of it is driven in large part by loans from banks to other banks. Now, what to make of that? I'm not really sure, but it's observable. It's also observable that compensation levels in the financial sector have risen relative to compensation levels in virtually every other sector. It's observable that graduates of the best, you know, universities gravitate to Wall Street much more so today than they did 30 years ago because of the returns on Wall Street are so much higher.
Mm-hmm.
And is this healthy from society's overall point of view? Well, and that's sort of a value judgment, a policy judgment. I don't think so. I'd be, and I think one can properly raise the question whether the financial sector hasn't grown larger than is socially efficacious, and in the process hasn't created substantial risks, because it's grown by loans. And, you know, going back to my earlier point, you can overdose on debt. And debt as a fraction of GDP all around the world has risen significantly. We got a lot more debt than we used to have, which means we got a much bigger financial sector. Now, there's a market correction going on here. It's sort of painful, but the financial sector is going to shrink. It's going to become smaller. It has to, because we're deleveraging, right? Paying down these debts, shrinking the debts, shrinking leverage, higher capital standards. So did the financial sector get too big? Absolutely. That's what the market's telling us. It's shrinking it, right? This is a market reaction. This isn't just Dodd-Frank and Basel rules. This is the marketplace saying, too much risk. Too much risk. Too much financial leverage. So we're getting a big correction, which I think is a healthy and a good thing. Did the financial sector get, was your question, get too big relative to everything else? Absolutely. How do we know? The market's telling us.
So that's a wonderful point to stop on.
Mm-hmm. Good. Hey, thanks. Good. Well, we could go on for a long time now.
All right. Thank you.